You're listening to the Illuminaire podcast, where we dive deep into behavioral health topics and shine a bright light on the forces shaping this industry's future. From research and technology to business and investment and more. Here's your host, Dr. Ronit Molko.
Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Ronit Molko, and thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Illuminaire podcast. Today, I am thrilled to welcome Jennifer Cook to the Illuminaire podcast. Jennifer is the author of 7 best-selling award-winning books on autism, which have now been translated into 6 languages. In fact, Jennifer is the best-selling female author of any single book in the genre and an award-winning international speaker. She's also brilliant and highly engaging and one of the leading change makers in neurodiversity empowerment. Jennifer, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. It's so funny. As you're speaking, I'm like, my eye contact is drifting off. I'm being so autistic right now, but I'm going, I'm just bashful. That's all. No.
That's okay. Eye contact required. There's no requirement.
Right. Yeah. No, thank you so much for the welcome. I appreciate that very, very much.
I'm so glad to have you here. You know, you had such a big impact on me when I met you 6 years ago. It was at the National Autism Conference.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
And, you know, you started talking to me about the differences in how autism impacts men versus women and how women are so misdiagnosed. And I have to admit, I was embarrassed because as a professional, I wasn't really thinking about that. I was kind of looking at the statistics, you know, 4-to-1 men to women, assuming that that was correct. And you really opened my eyes into the numbers may not be real, and this is something to really think about. Yeah. And one of the ways you brought it home to me was talking about women and heart disease. So can you share with our listeners, you know, kind of that parallel?
Absolutely. So the American Heart Association has a very famous, well, become very famous, and certainly out of Hollywood and on every cereal box in February, they have Red Dress Campaign. And basically, the Red Dress Campaign started because the vernacular, the way we all understood heart disease to present, was the way it looked in men. So what was happening was that a woman might start having symptoms of chest pain or even feeling, you know, gut pain and in ways that didn't seem very quote unquote heart attack like, right? At home, she wasn't maybe then being sent into the doctor, or in fact was going to the hospital and the physicians were saying, nope, you're fine, or it's this, that, or the other thing, it's stress, it's whatnot. And the issue was that in fact they were presenting with heart disease and that heart disease had become the leading killer of women. But simply because it didn't look the same, it didn't present the same way with women as it does in men, then they were being dismissed. And as soon as the portrait, if you will, of what heart disease could look like included the presentation in women, just some different symptoms showing the exact same thing going on inside, the death rates dropped, they plummeted. And that's what the whole Red Dress Campaign is about. It's actually about publicizing the female presentation, if you will, of heart disease. So it's sort of the same thing when it comes to autism. I have 3 children. They're on the spectrum. I am as well. And, you know, it always boggles my mind how much harder I had to work. And I do use that word to get my daughter's identification rather than her brother's. And really, they did the same sorts of things. They just looked a little different in pink. So it's the same setup. And you shouldn't feel embarrassed, because I would say that most, you know, experts in the U.S. for sure have traditionally gone by, well, if this is what the statistics are saying, and we're all using the same diagnostic tools and criteria, then this is what the result is. And you would be accurate. That would be actually, you know, you were spot on. If these are the tools that we use and the criteria that we use, then yep, 4-to-1 is completely the right ratio. But in Europe, they were really advocating a more gender neutral look and take in the actual diagnostic tools. And they started coming up with a 1-to-1 ratio versus a 4-to-1 ratio.
Wow. I didn't realize. I thought it was going to be 2-to-1, but I didn't realize 1-to-1.
1-to-1, which wow, is pretty massive, you know, of a change. And it's of monumental import, because unfortunately there are consequences to this being misdiagnosed truly for anyone, but especially for girls and women in the areas of self-harm, depression and eating disorders and abusive relationships, sexual violence in many cases. And so you have these horrible situations that were coming out of being missed or underdiagnosed, and really using the tools that y'all had in front of you, you were doing the right thing. It's just simply the tools were inaccurate.
So we know historically that the first 11 kids to be diagnosed with autism were boys. You know, the diagnostic history is very much around how boys present. So women are often misdiagnosed, as you said, with something else, like obsessive compulsive disorder, anxiety disorder, eating disorder, and the autism is missed. Right. How do you look at it now in terms of, you know, if a young woman is presenting with an eating disorder, what should doctors be looking for to go beyond that and not stopping at, oh, well, we found the eating disorder, so that must be what it is.
Right. Exactly right. These, I say that they ought to be, red flags, especially eating disorders. But whether it is OCD or anxiety or depression, do they occur on their own? Oh, of course they do. Of course. In both men, women, and I love there's a line from Kinky Boots, those who have yet to make up their minds, however you identify, there's that many ways of presenting as autistic. I mean, that's just the way it goes. But what we're talking about when it comes to girls and women is, because the consequences are so deadly, and that is the right word, deadly, it really is that much more important to look beyond. And that's where I kind of came up with this thing called the chick list checklist. What I really did was I took the original, as you said, first take a step back. As you said, Hans Asperger did his observation of boys. And, you know, it makes perfect sense. If I went out and I observed, you know, sunflowers, and I said, okay, flowers are these things that are tall and bright and strong and yellow. And then you showed me, you know, a petite teacup rose. And I would say that is not a flower, because it is not tall and strong and big and bright and yellow. However, it does have a stem. It does have petals. It does have so it's the same needs being expressed in different ways. And the problem is that diagnosticians in general aren't looking to find what the need is that's being filled by a behavior. If you're just looking to check off behaviors, yes, I see this, yes, I see that, no, I don't see this, you're going to end up with, you know, when I say shortcut diagnoses, like an OCD, like bipolar, that one is frequently misassigned. You stop too short. So it's not that, you know, it's not that there aren't OCD tendencies or anxiety or even, you know, tendencies that relate to a mood disorder. All of those things may absolutely be present, but it's a bit like me saying to you, oh, you poor thing, you know, you're coughing, and the next day, oh my gosh, you're coughing and sneezing. And the next day, oh my gosh, you're coughing, sneezing, and your eyes are running. And in fact, it's new. I just have a cold. It's one thing that encompasses everything else. Right. And so instead of these little piecemeal diagnoses, it's a matter of saying, where else can we go? But you can't do that unless you understand what needs someone might be trying to fulfill. And so that is what I did when, quite frankly, when my daughter, when things were just making sense to me, except for I had to put it together for psychologists in her life and for myself. You know, I was never a young Austrian boy who was, you know, focused on train timetables. That at this point I was, you know, a mom in a minivan with a nursing bra. You know, I mean, like this was not relatable content. But if I could go a little deeper and unzip and say, okay, so what is it about train timetables? Well, you know, there aren't even trains where I live, but I was and always have been very interested in genealogy. Those are trees that are really aligned very similarly with the way you might organize transportation kinds of tables, information tables, if you will. Okay, then that kind of worked, because I could see where the collection of information, the act of collecting information itself, was satisfying. And that's what it was. It didn't matter that it was trains specifically, you know, and to be very honest, growing up, I didn't have one of the questions in the ADOS is, you know, does the child spend time looking at the wheels or the parts of, right? And they're usually talking about like toy cars. I didn't have any toy cars. I had Barbies. I didn't have toy cars. You know, my daughter had maybe more of a variety, but I wasn't stuck on those little parts, but I did absolutely. I was fascinated by the parts of words. And, right. And in an echolalia kind of way, but I'm talking in a linguistics kind of way and etymology. So it's really, if you could understand and go through, well, these are the tendencies, there's the sensory things that are going to present with anybody. But beyond that, understanding the repetitive behaviors and what is the need? It's an anti-anxiety. Really, so much of what we present is anti-anxiety. But if you could look at that and then understand that our special interests, which are another kind of highlight, right? Let's say somebody's autistic, it may just look a little different. It might not be quite so avant-garde, if you will, in women.
So that's what you were talking about in your book when you were talking about the systematic gender bias that you experienced when your kids were getting diagnosed, was that they would ask you questions like, does she line up trucks?
Right.
And you were like, she doesn't have trucks. Does she line up toy cars? Does she? And you had to make the translation to
how it
translated in her play.
Exactly. And to be very honest, I always thought that was ironic anyway, because in real life, don't trucks or, you know, don't cars and trains actually line up? I always thought that was, you know, not so much the perfectionism as it was that's replicating, you know, I don't know. This is just me. It was pretty logical. But what my daughter did do, and certainly what I did, was I used to create these tableaus of my Barbies. And so where it would look like, you know, I was maybe doing interactive play, what I was really doing was I was maybe setting up wedding albums. So it would be really just a tableau, literally would take a picture, then reset, then this is the groom side of the family, take a picture, like, you know, or I can very clearly remember reenacting news stories that I had heard. There was one where my Barbie was a news reporter, and somebody was like, her sister was having a kidney transplant. What little child plays like that with Barbies? One who isn't necessarily creating. It sounds very original. It sounds very creative. No, I was reenacting what I heard on the news. Yeah.
Right. So interesting. So how did you figure out your diagnosis? That happened after your kids were diagnosed, right?
Right.
Or alongside that, simultaneous with that.
Well, pretty close. Yeah, exactly. You know, it's looking back on it, I was intuitively, I suppose, parenting them as an autistic parent. My parent autistic children, but as none of us had the, you know, quote unquote label at early on, it was just intuitive. It made sense to me, or the certain things. Some things made no sense to me. When my children would cry, which they did a lot as infants, and people would jangle, for instance, keys in their faces, right, or do something to distract them, that seemed like the most jarring experience you possibly could put somebody through. And I thought, if I were, you know, me right now, if I were upset over something and someone came and jangled keys in my face, I'd be darn annoyed. Like, that would not be helpful. And who would do that anyway? And it just, the things that people were recommending to me to do with these kids who were crying, it just didn't make sense. But what I did with them usually centered around sensory play and their special interests. I used their special interests as the way in. So whether that was, you know, teaching them certain social rules that I realize now I was analyzing on my own, you know, I might do it through using little pet shop animals or characters, or using one, you know, my daughter was absolutely enthralled with Greek and Roman mythology. So she would struggle with her handwriting, that she couldn't get it all in one spot. She was like a dyspraxia. She couldn't get them all the letters together as clearly as they needed to be. And so I gave her movable letters and let her do, and she made them up. Let her make up crosswords in Latin. And that was intriguing to her. Whereas maybe just doing a little kid crossword or playing around with letters wasn't, because she would have to manipulate. So anyway, the point of this all being, what I was doing was intuitively following the things that ironically turn out to be the exact diagnostic criteria of someone being on the spectrum.
And so you kind of saw that in her and identified it in yourself.
Yeah, I went through the actual criteria and then looked at, looked at Tony Atwood's book and set and looked at, he had, you know, for lack of a better term, sort of a portrait of, these are the more vernacular, the more observable ways, you know, in that someone would present with. And at this point it was Asperger syndrome. Because I have to admit, at that time, I would not have clued in with the word autism. That would not have fit what I was understanding. And that's a whole other topic, you know, autism, Asperger's. And I think some great things have happened as a result of changing the diagnosis. But
so that was actually going to be my next question.
Oh, okay.
That's how you feel about the changes made to the DSM and the removal of Asperger's. You know, just yesterday I got a call from an attorney mm-hmm. who's defending a boy with Asperger's who has some serious charges against him. Uh-huh. And she was saying that because he now is on the regular diagnostic spectrum, right. he's qualified as low need, low support need, because he's considered, you know, the old term of high functioning. Right. And so she can't get him treatment. And what a disservice it is, because this child would not, whether he did what he's being charged with or not is another question, but he wouldn't, you know, he needs support. He needs help. He needs treatment. He's not. And she can't get it now because he's lost that Asperger. So I'm interested in what you think about the change in diagnosis and the impact.
You know, at first I was really against it. And I was really against it because, you know, as if it mattered, but my opinion was I never would have sought out the Aspie, you know, really the phrase Aspie, became such a term of community, and it became such a positive spin on and for folks who maybe had not felt that the things that were uniting them were actually positive experiences, right? So suddenly the things that the quirks were actually the positive because they were the unifying factor. I thought that it was going to be really almost impossible to get. Generally, what I see is if there's a reluctance for a diagnosis, it's parental, you know, reluctance. If you're talking about an adult, usually for us, when we find out or that, you know, we are identified as being on the spectrum, there's a great sense of relief. For parents, I understand that's not always the case. I think my reaction was probably different, which was, thank God, now I understand. Now, if I have an if, then I have a then, and I can work with this. We're good, you know? But I realized that's not always the case. That if parents were already going to be kind of reluctant to possibly, you know, look down the avenue that would be Asperger's or autism, then to take away the differentiating factor, right, that was Asperger's, I thought we're in for real trouble. No one's going to, you know, look for it anymore. That being said, I realize now what we were doing is we were saying we're autistic, only not like you. And that's not cool. I realized that in hindsight, I'm so opposed to, and I heard you say that, you know, the old fashioned term, and unfortunately it's still used so frequently, the high functioning, low functioning, right? So a small anecdote, I was on a self-advocates panel once, and it was some really just, you know, we had Pulitzer Prize winners. And I mean, it was just an incredible group of people. And amongst the group, there was a young man who was in his mid-20s, and he was in a wheelchair and very much more classically presenting, right? So he used an iPad, he was nonverbal. And I was the one asked first, what's the hardest part about being on the spectrum? And my answer was, and always is still, wondering how you can simultaneously feel so smart and so stupid. And when the microphone came to him, his answer was that every single day he had to explain to somebody that he did not have any cognitive deficits. He simply couldn't, the way I describe it is he couldn't grab those words. They were in there, but he couldn't grab them. But if he was tested, he had a verbal IQ in the 150s, right? So well into the genius range. And I thought, I will remember this forever because this makes the point that high functioning and low functioning is always going to be a comparison. And you simply don't know. What I like to say is more and less obviously challenged. Right. Because I think that's what it comes down to. And when you're talking just the case that you're talking about, right, that's a situation where, and then the reality is that the less obviously someone is challenged, the more likely you are to see dangerous behavior, to see self-harm, and to see, unfortunately, suicide, because you have a greater, you know, breakdown of the family expectation of being able to fulfill all the general, you know, social requirements, if you will, and professional requirements of life. But we don't, reality and expectation don't match. And so for me, in the end, I've come to this place where I am not a person who gets hung up on words. It doesn't matter to me if it, you say autistic person, person with autism, person living with, like that, just, I always say, like, whatever you call me, as long as it's nice, it's fine. But, but the one thing I do get hung up on is that high and low functioning, because I think a lot of times what it really is more highly masked.
It's the invisible disability, right? Because the person looks like they're coping really well and there's all the stuff going on inside.
Right, exactly. And when we quote unquote mess up, it just comes across as being that we're rude, or, you know, that we're non-thinking, not compassionate. And gosh knows that's just as far as can be from the truth. But for sure, if you are living life with, you know, playing the game of life without the rule book, then, you know, you're in trouble. You know, that's, in fact, I think it was when we met, may well have been, was my second book was called The Secret Book of Social Rules. And honestly, that was the greatest thing that it had won book of the year that year at that conference. And that book was, I didn't think anyone would read it. This tells you how completely oblivious we can be to what actually is going on. But because I actually, after I was diagnosed, after I had peeled back all the layers, made sense of the fact that I was, yep, doing all the same things as the guys were doing, only just slightly different, but achieving the same ends. I realized that if I could nail down the behavioral patterns of the world, life would be a lot better. And it's amazing how that can be the case, but we have to do it for ourselves, because sometimes it's not just that which seems obvious is not so obvious. You don't know what you don't know if you're neurotypical either. So.
Right, right, exactly. What's your perspective on neurodiversity? You know, you talk in your new website about the human spectrum and neurodiversity. Yeah. You know, some parents are very anti because their kids are severely impacted, and they say that kind of leaves them behind.
Yeah.
You know, it's very hard to celebrate neurodiversity when your child needs three caretakers at all times because they're so, you know, their self-harm is so intense. And so
absolutely
interested in your perspective on that.
You know, I think it would be arrogant of me to say that I know what that experience is like to be a parent of a child who is, for instance, that, you know, that in need of that highly in need of constant care. What I can say is, however, that I tell stories. So I'm going to tell the story of Eddie. I had run a class for, it was at our local church, and it was when the typical kids would go to class. If a child needed just some extra break room time, whatever the case may be, they could hang out with me. So basically I was the hangout lady. And Eddie came in and was getting in trouble because he kept taking off his shoes. And you're not allowed to take off your shoes inside the building. And he, you know, kept going over to the water fountain, turning on the water, kept trying to. So he would be rubbing his feet on people. Everyone was getting aggravated. All I did was say, give him one of those nubby seats, the sensory seat, so that he could, and let that be his. He took off his shoes and simply rocked his feet on it. And the rest of the year, although he was nonverbal, he was calmed enough just by doing that, that if he saw someone was upset, he would go over and give them a hug. This is a child who, you know, had been written off in for most senses. And there he was being able to show compassion and empathy. Simply the change for him simply was because he could get his body calm enough just by getting the dang shoes off and being able to rock. Now, here's the thing. He had a caretaker with him at the time. He had an aide with him. There were multiple teachers around too, right? And gosh knows his parents worked super hard with him. And, you know, he went to a special school. They did everything they could. Sometimes I think, though, that it was only because I was on the spectrum and I saw him doing what he was doing. It's like unzipping the Hans Asperger boys. It was the same thing. I could basically put myself in his perspective, which is ironically what it's so hard for us to do, theory of mind wise, to put ourselves in somebody else's perspective. Well, I could do it with him and could figure out what does he need? And that happened without anyone telling me. It's the same thing that that this social rule book, obviously, you know, not every person on the spectrum is going to be able to sit down and read a book. I get that. But breaking them down into the same little chunks is something that we've done with folks who are in the same, who have cognitive deficiencies as well. And just being able to say, stop, wait, look, little teeny chunks, you can do the same thing because we're going through the same experiences. It's just the volume is turned up to different levels some days. So I will never be arrogant enough to say, I know what your walk is like in life, because I won't do that to anyone in any case. I simply don't. But I do know that I do know that someone on the spectrum has to be the one to speak for someone on the spectrum. And will we get it perfectly every time? Absolutely not. But I do think we will most certainly get it closer to right, simply because it's our intuition.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. Jennifer, you talk about synesthesia, and probably a lot of people don't know what that is. Can you describe that, and how does it enhance your life? Does it make life more challenging? I'm just curious.
Yeah. So synesthesia, this is one of those things that, you know, looking back on. So the weird thing about being diagnosed as an adult is that you look back on your life and you think, you know, I've been doing this whole making my choices independently throughout my whole life, doing my thing. This is my crafted existence in the world. And then you look back, realizing that you're on the spectrum. It's like, dang, I had the autism engineer just saying, you know, turn right, turn left the whole time. And I was doing it the whole time. You know, you don't realize it's kind of a weird situation. And growing up, what you do know is, you know, something's a little different. Well, one of the first somethings that I was cognizant of being a little different was I think I was maybe four. And I said to my mom that the numbers were odd. And I can remember, and she said, she didn't know I meant odd and even. When I said they were odd, she thought I was talking about them being strange, because I said they're odd because they're boys. And she said, no, that would be strange. I said, no, the odd numbers are boys. But she had already told me this is strange. So when I said, and the even numbers are girls, and she looked at me as if I had two heads, I figured this is going down the wrong road. So then when I was, you know, able to associate and able to tell her that also letters were different colors, so were the numbers. And I wasn't, like, you know, looking at something, a toy, and saying, well, the number two is purple. No. By the way, the number two is not purple. Number eight is forest green. That's right. For me, numbers and letters are associated with gender and with color and personality. And it is as real to me as, you know, as crazy as it sounds to you, which I realize is the case. Synesthesia is the experience when more than one of your senses are operating, if you will, at the same time, so that you're taking up, there might be a flavor to music. There might be a scent to a poem. And it's not imagined. It can be tested to the hilt. And oddly enough, I did not know this, of course, but it is the rates of a synesthete being somebody on the autism spectrum are through the roof, even more specifically women. I can't tell you how many times I've gotten, I love it. It tickles me when I'll get messages or letters or emails from gals who will say, love this, this was great, blah, 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 but you're wrong. number seven is actually a girl from Topeka. And, you know, whereas me, no, are you kidding? Number seven is a boy. And, you know, I could tell you exactly that it is a strange experience, I know, but it's my normal. And I guess that's what autism is in general. You know, for me, it's like, you poor people, you live in a black and white world. You know, there's so much more to it. It's like talking to someone, I suppose, who is colorblind, and how do you explain what color is?
Right.
The same thing. But yeah, it's a neat thing. I think it is a great concrete sort of way also to illustrate how real are the neurological differences. You know, I think it's so easy to just want to say get on with it on a day-to-day basis. But
does it impact you in a way where you might look at a word or a name and go, this is in the wrong order, or there are too many male letters next to female? Like, does it dysregulate? Can it be dysregulating?
No, but what it does do is this. So, you know, Temple Grandin talks about thinking in pictures, right? And so that she would need to see a certain number of churches before she would be able to generalize to the concept of church. Okay. Like Google for images is what she says. Well, for me, I also see concrete things, but I'm seeing a word. So if you say to me blue, I see B-L-U-E, the letters. I don't see the color. And so actually what it's done is helped me probably with word retention and with etymology, and therefore probably some crazy things to my vocabulary, because I'm seeing the parts and pieces like a puzzle, and they move around for me, which is kind of neat. The one thing where it does give me trouble is if you would meet like a Daniel and a David, I see the DA in the beginning and then an I at the end. So it may well be a Daniel, David. I will get lost as to who is what. So that does happen. It's a little bit like, I suppose, forgetting a face if it's a little too close. So, you know, identical twins, who's who. And to me, those are identical shapes. So, and that's what it looks like to me in my head. Look off the window, it's shapes. Yeah. So
very interesting.
Yeah. I know.
So let's talk about the checklist, because I love the items you have on there. And I think it really helps people, you know, to understand, you know, for example, eye contact. You say women manage eye contact, so it's less detectable that they're avoiding it, whereas with boys, it's just more obvious.
It is. It tends to be more obvious. You know, that's when a lot of women or mothers of daughters will hear is that she makes eye contact. Well, okay, it's how does she and when does she, right? So first of all, there's that third eye spot that a lot of people look at, because if you're looking at that spot between the nose, essentially, you know, you're giving the other person the sense that you're making eye contact without the sensory input being too loud, which is what it really is if you're necessarily making regular eye contact. So for me, what I do is that when, you know, you'll ask me a question, I'll look at you and I'll then process and look off kind of up and up, you know, off to the sky. And what I'm doing is I'm thinking, right? But it doesn't look quote unquote abnormal. It just looks like I'm thinking, well, which I am. I just do it a lot more. I look around a lot more. So, but I will always come back to your face. And it's because I come back to your face that it's maybe a typical eye contact, but unless you are actually really looking for it and understanding that it doesn't have to just be turned the other direction or down, that it can kind of be, I would look at a piece of artwork. I remember being in an office and I would look at a piece of artwork and kind of gaze off into the middle distance, and it looks contemplative, which it is, but it's also a bit of an escape tactic.
Right. Yeah. Right. So interestingly, as a clinician, one of the first things I was taught 30 something years ago when working with kids with autism was the first thing you have to do is teach eye contact, because through eye contact, they're going to learn imitation. They're going to copy your lips. They're going to. Right. So what's your thinking on that now? Obviously that from what I've learned from autistic individuals is it's physically painful. It's just intolerable to make eye contact with someone. And so to think that we were taking all these little kids and starting off with forcing them to make eye contact essentially, or, you know, and then expecting them to sit and learn for 2 hours. I mean,
And that's one of those things. What it's, and I get it. And that's to go back to your question earlier about neurodiversity. And that's why it has to be somebody on the spectrum speaking for for folks on the spectrum, even for those who can't get the words themselves. That's not to say we don't want input from everybody in people's lives, but it is to say that at least first you got to listen to that intuition that comes from an autistic brain. So to your kind of question, it is the way I explain the eye contact thing is like being in a really noisy restaurant. And if you and I were to go to a really noisy restaurant and you are now telling me the deepest secret of your soul, right? And it is the most important thing you've ever actually got decided to share with someone. And it's, you know, order up for this, that, and the other thing. And then we go outside and you ask me a question about what you've said. And I clearly can't show comprehension, how are you going to feel? You're going to feel like I didn't care. And I get that, right? But that's what the sensory overload feels. It's too loud. You can't see, you know, that's what it is. So, I don't think it's wrong to try to achieve the end. And this is again, where I say about unzipping the need. Well, what is the need? Eye contact, first and foremost, makes the other person feel as though they're being heard and are important. Yes? Okay. Well, you can learn there's nothing wrong with facing your body towards another person. That's absolutely. And the other thing is that third eye that I teach, I actually will sometimes put a little, you know, star sticker right between someone's eyes or right up there on the, I know where folks can't see me, but right, you know, between your eyebrows right there, the bridge of your nose. And that's because if you can learn to look there, again, it's going to give that sense that you're in fact making eye contact when you're not. And it's easy enough to, I can then still see your body and see what you're doing. I can easily then look to your arm if I'm supposed to replicate what you're doing with your hand or whatever the case may be. So you're close enough to give the person that feeling, but then also to, you know, give yourself enough of a cushion.
A cushion. Yeah, that makes sense. Special interests are really interesting, right? Because it's one of the ways we identify and diagnose. But as you say in your book, women's special interests are just more, for lack of a better term, socially acceptable, right? You might be interested in the royal family or French history, right. Whereas boys might be more interested in the manufacturers of toilets or
exactly,
you know, engineering equipment or something that not everyone's going to want to talk about. So exactly how do that becomes an area where diagnosticians will say the special interest is not, they won't identify the special interest as being right, unusual or standing out. And therefore that's another characteristic that doesn't get checked.
But it can be if you're looking at the quantity of information, and that's what it is, right? So it's not just the topic, and though that certainly makes it easier when there's an obscure topic and you can tell with a little boy that, right, I remember one child, his thing was parking garages. Okay, not too many kids are going to want to talk about parking garages, right? But with the girls, you're right, and with the women, our topics tend to be more quote unquote, stereotypically female. They tend to be, you know, more like you said, socially acceptable, but it is the level. So it's, again, it's doing the human, I always say this, that, you know, it's the same life on the human spectrum, but with the volume turned up. And that's what it is. So if you have a child, I'm going back to my daughter, well, her thing now is Disney. Disney is a very common special interest among women and girls too. So when she was little, you know, it was the princesses and da, 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 da. But now it's Disney history, and it's the, you know, she could tell you what's going on in any park, you know, in the world, and the new fireworks, this, there, the other thing, and to the scientific levels of what the Imagineers do. Okay, that's not something usually somebody who just happens to like going to Disney World knows, right? It's a different level. It's a professorial level. And also you might notice that some of them tend to be intense but short-lived. That's another way to watch, thing to look out for, as well as those interests often focus on a person, a real person. Sometimes it's fictional, but often it's a biography in the sense that we study real women over time to learn how to be is the expression often that I hear. And so you can look for frequent topics often do include Disney mythologies, fashion culture and history. You'll also see genealogy is a big one. And what else would I say are the tops? Mermaids, fairies, and I'm talking in the sense of like mythical lore, right? So it's more and historical fiction too. So it's really in the sense of folklore. But yeah, and historical fiction is a ginormous one. But yeah, then you add a little bit of time travel and you sound like one of the guys. So, you know. Right.
So that's such a great takeaway is the volume. Look for the volume.
Yeah.
That's really helpful. You talk about women acting in versus acting out. Can you talk about that?
Sure. And that's unfortunately part of the seriousness of not being identified. You know, when you don't understand why it is, you know, when you're trying, like anything, to fit in, to do, you feel that you're doing what everybody else is doing, but for whatever reason, it keeps not working socially. When you feel that you're kind of just always outside the happy, happy hour, you know, and that can be as a kid in school, can be as a mom on the, you know, at a PTA meeting, or when everybody at work is, you know, getting together and the last thing you want to do is exactly that. You'll see that perfectionism rears its ugly head in one of two ways. One, either the app have to be the best at absolutely everything. Or the other is that I'm so daunted by the prospect of not doing something perfectly that I won't try in the first place. And in either case, you end up punishing yourself when things don't go well. And so the punishment tends to look frequently. You'll see there's cutting, skin picking, hair pulling. Those are big. Because we're also tend towards repetitive behavior, eating disorders, for gosh sakes, eating disorders, that is repetitive behavior within an OCD kind of framework, you know, where you can also be quantifiable about it and then get your brain into losing itself in the minutia of, I can very clearly remember when I was in my 20s, I was hospitalized for anorexia and I had a spreadsheet, you know, that would calculate the grams of this, that, and the other thing that I was having every day, and talk about being able to, there we go. I didn't get lost in the minutia of cars, but I got lost in the minutia of counting grams. But what you see is I've had too many stories where, unfortunately, where if the young woman had known about her own autism, where she never would have suffered nearly as long, or in some several cases would still be with us. The pain. Of not understanding that smart but so stupid feeling is excruciating. And we all know the pain of feeling left out, of being excluded, is excruciating. Everybody's felt that at some point. But when you constantly feel as though you're trying and one slip up away, it's, you know, they say imposter syndrome. I don't know. I think it's just an extension of perfectionism, but it's in this case, we are living in imposter syndrome. We're living the imposter life where we're trying to be something that we're not, even if we're not doing it consciously, we're copying, we're mimicking, you know, the whole time we're parroting. Sometimes exactly. And we don't understand. We also find ourselves in situations like, for instance, I can remember once being invited to, you know, come up to someone's apartment to listen to music, does not actually listen to any more than Netflix and chill ever meant watching Netflix, right? The same idea that you can find yourself in really difficult, dangerous situations because you're not seeing the nuance. So.
Right. And I remember you talking about that 6 years ago in your speech, and, you know, I've spoken to so many young women who've had that experience, right, in college or going on their first date and not understanding what could happen or what the intentions were, and taking things very much at face value.
Absolutely. Yeah. It gets scary, you know, and the worst things, I think, you know, we always say, right, bruises heal, but words, those are the ones that stick.
Right.
We're the ones we speak to ourselves. You know, that's why.
Right, exactly.
The greatest gift I can give to folks is when I can convince, you know, a woman that she is in fact a miracle, not a mistake. It doesn't get better than that, because we are all looking to belong. We're all looking for a sense of, you know, connection and of validation. And when oftentimes those people who love you the most, have erred in understanding you, and perhaps made the love kind of come out sideways, or those who have claimed to love you have hurt you, obviously the result is going to be that there's going to be a certain amount of self-loathing, and you want to get rid of that no matter what. And it is for women. We're not going to be as often the child who has a temper tantrum and screams at the teacher because we follow the rules. We're going to be the one who simply melts down inside.
So the memorization of social rules and the mimicking of social behaviors is kind of what actually makes it more difficult for women, right? Because they look like they've got it and they get what's going on and they're
right.
But essentially they're.
There's just that difference. It's so funny the way I was about to say it. I was going to say it's turquoise versus cobalt blue. So there we go. It's just that slight difference where you've got most of the flavor of the recipe right, but there's just something off. There's just a little something off. That's really what I think has to be looked for so gently. I mean, even amongst the questions of and I know you've heard this before of not saying, so do you have friends? But okay, well, tell me about your friends, because oftentimes the reciprocity is not there. So either it's not a real friendship, or you're not being invited to do things with that person. It's just someone that you've created an attachment to,
Right. Or a child sits next to another child at lunch every day. So they think they're a friend, but it's not actually a.
Exactly. And that boundary between people can be even such that my son, I remember he thought he was getting in terrible trouble. And this is in grade school, because the teacher was yelling at him, he said, every day. And turned out the teacher was yelling at another child who sat, like you said, next to him. But the sense of self can be so permeable. And that is, I think that's true for both boys and girls. I do think that I see that more so with girls. Especially as we get into the dating years, then it's very easy to be told who and how you are. When you're trying to copy and follow directions to be something other than what you are, then when you're being told you are this, it's very easy to uptake and believe.
Right, right. Absolutely. Yeah, that's profound. That's really beautiful. What a gift your kids have to have you as their mom.
I love
because you, because you get to see things, right? That a typical parent might misinterpret and not really understand what's going on.
I think so. I hope so. I'm sure there are. I can look back and I can remember very clearly a teacher asking me, oh, well, give me all you have on your daughter, and my kids are very typically presenting, right? So again, they're in that challenge zone because of that. But the teacher asked me for everything that I'd like to send. So I sent everything I had on autism and sensory things and blah, 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 blah. And so we're talking, a file that's 2-3 inches thick because that's what the teacher had asked for everything I had. So I gave everything I had. And of course, what does the teacher think? The teacher thinks this is the most obnoxious helicopter parent I've ever met before. And she thinks, I can't do my job. And that did not, win friends and influence people for me, at least not in a positive direction. Right. So I know that there have been times too that I've stepped in it. And I guess what it comes down to in the end is our kids are all lucky if we're just trying our very best.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
I know we could talk forever. Is there any one thing on the checklist that I haven't mentioned that you think people really should hear about?
I think you've touched on the most important. I really do. I think that helping us above all things to realize that we are how we are for a reason. And that's not in the identification, but it's, I suppose, the reason for identification. Do I think that's important even? Are we going to be in big trouble if we don't get spotted? And I say the import says yes. I mean, it's a tragedy to see someone who is differently wired not realize that they're differently wonderful. And I think if that can be the great gift of the checklist, which, has like 20 bullet points, but or more. Actually, I had a gal write to me the other day. It's more than that, because she said, I got 20 out of whatever, you know, is that enough? I said, yes, I think that's clinically significant, you know. but I think it's simply being able to say, okay, I'm willing to learn this with you alongside, learn about you along with you, whether you're a parent, a partner, a friend. That's what I hear the most, is that once they understand themselves, women and girls often feel kind of, you know, feel relieved, but is there going to be anyone there who's willing to listen and walk the walk with them? And so I think being able to do that, or making it clear that you will, that's the most important thing.
Right. And so that leads us to your new organization, Belong.
Oh, yeah. Really.
Can you share a little bit about that?
Yeah. So Belong came out of basically, you know, when I wrote Autism Heals, the most recent book, I wrote it hoping that there would be a lot of diagnosticians reading it as well. It's a memoir. And, you know, it certainly has, that has been the case, but the profound, you know, resonating voices are from women who are going, oh boy, yep, that's me. I used to call it the ladies' room crowd, because I would give a talk and inevitably I'd go to the bathroom and afterwards I'm being followed by, you know, by people to the ladies' room and saying, I think that's me, I think that's me. If all these people who were saying, I think that's me, could know that they weren't the only one, because that was what it would hear over and over. I think I'm the only one, but I think I'm the only one. And I thought, if you could only know how one of many you are. And I was getting all these emails and messages that, you know, okay, well, where can I connect with other people? Where can I learn more about it? How can I understand myself better? And there was no place. There was no place I could send everyone. So there was the what next, and there was no next. So that's what I created. And it's a community that now connects women in 12 different countries around the world. We started off, or it starts off with a course called the Mistake to Miracle course. And that is, golly, there's 72 video lessons in there. And it is all about really coming to understand yourself in the way that you think, in the way that you your emotional intelligence, understanding your sensory experiences, understanding your neurology. But what it comes down to really is the connections and the friendships, I think, that are being made. And we've had more than one person say, this has literally changed my life or saved my life. And to me, it doesn't get better than that. So we're actually in a period right now, because I don't open it except for every 3 or 4 months, because I really get very involved. We have guests. Now, I know that I'm holding you to it, that you're going to be one of my masterclass guests. Our next one is the director of all things autism the National Institutes of Health. We have tremendous people who come on and share with us. And so we're actually open right now. And if you just go to what is nowyoubelong.com/sneak peek, you'll be able to find out about it. Otherwise, it would be /welcome. But I'm really proud of it. And so if you are someone who is identified or feels like you ought to be, I invite you to come and check it out. Very, very proud of it. And so far, the feedback has been wonderful. So we'd love to have you.
That's fantastic. I mean, what a beautiful thing you've created, because, you know, as we've talked about, I get so many calls from people, and, you know, where do you send people? What resources are they out there? So that's a beautiful thing that you've created.
Thank you. I'm very proud of it, but I also feel very blessed by it. So it's good stuff. It's really good stuff. Yeah.
Right. Well, Jennifer, thank you so, so much. I love your books. I've read all of them. I recommend them to people all the time. I think they're fantastic.
Thank you.
As I say, you changed my whole perspective 6 years ago. And, you know, I talk to people about this quite a bit, because so many women are suffering that don't need to be. And so thank you for the work that you do. Thank you for taking your time to share with me. And thank you for sharing all your insight with our listeners. It's really, really appreciated.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. I thank you so much for having me. Absolutely. And I cannot believe it's been 6 years. My God, as long as the kids are the only ones getting older and not us, we're good.
Exactly, right?
Thanks for listening to the Illuminaire Podcast with Dr. Renit Molko. If you like what you heard today, please subscribe, rate, review, and share our show with other listeners. See you next week.